Welcome to the Master Your Health podcast, your top resource for all things nutrition, fitness, and health. I'm your host, Amanda Rocchio, best known for my meal prep and nutrition content. And today I'm here with my co-host, the research junkie between the two of us, and my husband, Chris Rocchio.
Hello, everyone. And really quick, let me just read a review from one of our listeners. This one was actually through Instagram direct message. Chris and Amanda are awesome. I could tell they had amazing chemistry 2 seconds into listening to their podcast. I'm an aspiring pro beach volleyball player, and I look forward to continuing to listen to their work to maximize my potential. Keep dropping those gems. Last thing, the way you dig deep into the research and provide practical takeaways for your listeners is very much appreciated. Well, thank you, Andre. That's one of the best reviews we can possibly ask for.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And if you could take a moment, pause this podcast, leave us a review in iTunes or wherever you're listening to this podcast, that would mean so much to Chris or I. Now, just a heads up, we're obviously recording this podcast on Squadcast versus our usual mics because we had a special guest on today and it was really worth using Squadcast to talk to him because boy, does he know his stuff. His name is Dr. James D. Nicolantonio, and he is a cardiovascular research scientist and a doctor of pharmacy. He is the author or co-author of approximately 200 publications in the medical literature. I mean, that's a heck of a lot of publications. He also is on the editorial advisory boards of several medical journals. So let me just say, he knows his stuff, and he dives into the research so much, and he's written a bunch of books, but this one in particular we're talking about today is called Immunity Fix by Dr. James.
Yeah, and some of the other ones he's written are The Salt Fix, Superfuel, and The Longevity Solution. We have all three of those as well, and they're definitely amazing books. You should check those out as well. But for today, we're just focusing on the Immunity Fix because of its obviously practical applications and our problems today.
What I really liked about today's episode is he does tie immune health in specifically to better COVID-19 outcomes, because as you know, on the episode, Chris and I did a podcast on immune health, but we stayed kind of broad and talked about general health. And he really relates all this stuff, you know, whether it comes to your immune health or your overall metabolic health, back to how it'll also help you when it comes to COVID-19 outcomes.
Yeah, and his style is a little bit different than what you're used to. There's a lot of people on podcasts that like to hear themselves speak. He is very direct and concise in his answers, and so it's actually very efficient. You actually think he's going to go on this huge spiel, and then he just gives you a nice boom, 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 a nice little talking point, and just moves on. So this is actually like a nice little spitfire interview, and I think you guys are going to enjoy it.
Absolutely. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. And I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. James D. Nicolantonio.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. Chris and I are actually huge fans of your Instagram. We love that you bust so many different myths on there. And we know you have a new book out called Immunity Fix, which is very timely considering the pandemic, all that's going on in the world. So I wanted to start the show off with a question around that book, which is, you know, there's a little bit debate over whether or not you can boost your immune system, enhance your immune system. What are your thoughts around that? Is it true? Can you do things to change it, modulate it? Let us know.
Well, I mean, the short answer is absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a couple aspects to how well anyone actually fights off an infection. One would be starting with your own health of your mucous membranes, which, you know, vitamin A and vitamin D are super important for forming, you know, epithelial layers, mucous membrane layers. Same with riboflavin as well. Most people are deficient in those nutrients. And then, of course, you have your own immune cells, which can take up things like vitamin C and other nutrients as well, magnesium. And, you know, when those immune cells actually become deficient in certain vitamins and minerals, they do not kill viruses as well.
Awesome. And then could you maybe also talk about one of the main things that we get online when we talk about, you know, immune boosting, especially since the pandemic started, is that you just cannot boost. Can you maybe explain to them in the simplest terms the mechanism about how they actually get the boost, how the immune function does get a little stimulation by certain activities, certain diets, or things like that?
Sure. So typically what they measure is something called the phagocytic index, like how well white blood cells can actually engulf and take care of things like bacteria, for example. So on the flip side, you can have things that inhibit that. So just consuming 100 grams of glucose will suppress your phagocytic activity by about 5 hours. Whereas if you consume like a nutrient-dense diet, that can increase the phagocytic activity of your white blood cells. So really, that's typically how you measure how well your immune systems are working through those types of indexes.
That was nice and concise.
I love it. I like that. So what are some of the worst things you can do? Because you kind of brought up glucose and all that when it comes to like hindering your immune system, like suppressing it almost in a way.
So you know all those like vegetable oils that we're told to consume that help lower cholesterol? They can actually get into all the immune cells and make them more pro-inflammatory. And so that's really a problem with what we're seeing with COVID-19 is a lot of people have too much inflammation in the lungs causing that cytokine storm. So if you have immune cells that are saturated with those omega-6 seed oils, that's going to increase the production of those pro-inflammatory cytokines and damage your lungs even more.
Say across the board, all seed oils would fit that category, or are there some exceptions?
There's exceptions, yeah. So black seed oil would be actually on the opposite end of the spectrum. It actually has been shown to help people with COVID-19. So there was one preprint study in over 300 COVID patients. They gave them about 6 grams of partially ground black cumin seeds with raw honey, and that significantly cut mortality, increased viral clearance, and reduced hospital stay by several days. And another exception to that seed oil being bad rule is evening primrose. So evening primrose oil is sort of an exception to that. But your things like corn, safflower, sunflower, cottonseed, those types of oils, especially when you cook with them, create so much oxidative stress and damage. And then you consume that and that just saturates your immune cells with these pro-inflammatory oxidized omega-6 oils.
I didn't even know it worked that way. That's pretty crazy.
No, I did not.
And then, so you also talk about how you should really limit your refined carbohydrates and refined sugar. Does that have to do kind of what you mentioned with the glucose earlier? Like what exactly does that do when it comes to your immune system?
So one way that actually how this works and damages the immune system and leads to more inflammation is through the receptor for advanced glycation end products. So the more glucose you consume and sugars, the more advanced glycation end products that you form in the body, which is essentially like these glycated proteins. And there's a receptor for those called receptor for advanced glycation end products that can actually take up SARS-CoV-2. So the more RAGE receptors that you have, the more sort of your body is taking up SARS-CoV-2, which can then activate the pro-inflammatory response. So that's one way. But then the other way is you're damaging the inside of your body, right? Your intestinal health. You're glycating your red blood cells, which are needed to oxygenate. And we know that there's a tremendous increased risk in cardiovascular issues, thrombosis issues. And we know high glucose diets increase coagulation in the blood as well. So it's very likely that if you have elevated blood glucose or A1C levels, you're going to have worse COVID outcomes.
One of the things that maybe would help us just lay it out for some of our listeners is that, could you maybe in kind of like a bullet point fashion talk about some of the main factors in overall immune health? And then we can just maybe chip away at some of those after you list them out.
Sure, I can do that. Well, I think everybody knows that advanced age is a huge risk factor. So if you're over the age of 60, you're at about a 9-fold higher risk of dying from COVID-19. But if you have a severe vitamin D deficiency, you're actually at a 15-fold higher risk of dying. And you can't change your age, but you can absolutely improve your vitamin D levels. So it just goes to show you that being deficient in just one nutrient, vitamin D, is actually a worse risk factor than being advanced age. And 1 billion people globally are vitamin D deficient, and half the global population is vitamin D insufficient. And that's because either lack of sunlight. As we age, so the elderly produce actually 75% less vitamin D when they're exposed to the sun. So they almost need to get either supplemental or dietary sources of vitamin D. And then most of us aren't activating our vitamin D very well because we're magnesium deficient. So in the body, we have these enzymes that convert vitamin D to calcidiol and then to calcitriol, which is the active hormone. And those enzymes need magnesium. So, and about 50% of people aren't getting enough magnesium in the diet. So vitamin D, magnesium are super important for immunity, but the list goes on and on. Selenium, vitamin C, every single vitamin and mineral has some type of function when it comes to immune health.
And then what about, and there's also some debate that we get online from some of our listeners, because we talk about fasting and intermittent fasting sometimes. And one of the big questions that we get is surrounding coffee and tea and whether or not that kicks us, you know, because one of the main benefits of fasting is autophagy. And one of the main debates is whether or not coffee and tea kicks us out of autophagy or if that is able to be sustained, even if we're able to have just a little bit of caffeine to push us through that fast. Could you maybe address that? Because I know fasting is one of the, you know, a huge issue for immune system sometimes.
Right. So we don't have, to my knowledge, we don't have data in actual humans around this topic, but we do in animal studies. And the animal studies show that actually drinking coffee induces autophagy. So it wouldn't suppress autophagy. It would actually enhance the benefits of fasting as long as you're not adding things like sugar or a lot of heavy cream, so to speak, to your coffee.
So all the coffee lovers raise their hand right now. That's great news. I've never been. I'll do a little dance.
Well, yeah, because one of the main things was that I think it was Dr. Rhonda Patrick on Joe Rogan was the person that was putting the fear in some people, especially me, because she was saying that as soon as your cells are going into like basically processing anything metabolically, like so any foreign compound is going to essentially jumpstart that system. So you're saying that that's been disproven essentially.
At least in animal models, yeah.
Awesome.
We'll volunteer as test subjects human models. So another thing you obviously emphasize in Immunity Fix is metabolic health. And having good metabolic health, I mean, helps you in so many different ways, but obviously also with COVID-19 outcomes. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen with that and maybe a few of your biggest takeaways for improving your metabolic health?
Yeah, I think the key with metabolic health is you can look great on the outside. You can be thin and actually have a ton of what's called visceral fat. So you really don't know just by looking at someone if they're metabolically healthy. And so you really do need to look at certain blood work to kind of indicate if someone has what's called metabolic syndrome, which is essentially having three or more of the following five conditions: high blood glucose, high blood pressure, high waist circumference, high triglycerides, and low HDL. If you have three or more of those, you have metabolic syndrome. And when you have that syndrome, which typically you do have a larger waist circumference. That's a good, you just look in the mirror. And if you have a little bit of, around your waist, the circumference is increased. You can still be thin, but if you have that little sort of, you know, pouch in around the stomach, that can indicate the visceral fat. Metabolic syndrome increases the risk of dying from COVID-19 by about 3.5-fold and increases the risk of ending up in the ICU by 4.5-fold. And so you can fix metabolic syndrome within just weeks of going from a refined carbohydrate seed oil diet to a natural diet. So this is something that people can do really quickly. You don't have to wait for a vaccine to come out to sort of help your own metabolic health to fight against viruses.
I know. I wish this message would get out there more, which is why I'm so happy you're on today. Just really busting through some of these myths when it comes to what you can do for COVID-19 besides just social distancing and wearing a mask. It's not talked about enough, really.
Do you think that the number one thing with, you know, definitely reducing refined carbohydrates and seed oils is stop ordering like takeout and things like that? Because I noticed that like that's what they're mostly cooking with to save money. They're not cooking with the good oils, like, you know, like olive oil and avocado. It's mostly like canola oil and things like that. Do you think that just switching over from takeout to just home cooked is enough to like flip the script essentially?
Yeah, well, because you hit the nail right on the head, right? They're cooking in canola oil typically, or even the foods at a hot bar typically are infused with canola oil. Or sunflower or things like that. And so, you know, they dump a ton of that oil in there. And, you know, really just probably getting anywhere from 5 to 10 grams of that type of rancid oil over the course of several weeks is definitely going to cause a lot of damage. So just cooking at home, I really do think that's such a quick, easy fix to getting people's metabolic health back on track.
You say to somebody who's, you know, playing devil's advocate or on the other side of the spectrum that is just following the calorie model. So say, for instance, let's just say, you know, their macros allow for like 100 grams of fat a day, right? And let's just say they're in a 10 calorie deficit. So they're just in a slight deficit or whatever. So they're hypothetically and theoretically using up all of that energy that they're eating in that day. But you're saying there's still an issue with that seed oil being in there, right? Because it's still happening on the cellular level and the hormonal level, correct?
Exactly. You can't exercise your way out of tissue damage. And so, you know, it's almost like if you're in a calorie deficit, it doesn't make something that's injurious or to your own self less harmful. If something creates oxidative stress, it's going to do that whether you're in a calorie deficit or not. Simply how, like take sugar, for example. If you consume a high sugar load, even if throughout the day you're in a calorie deficit, when your intestinal cells metabolize that sugar, that creates oxidative stress, whether you're in a calorie deficit or not. And so that can lead to, right, intestinal permeability. And then all of a sudden you have food particles coming into your blood and causing, you know, lipopolysaccharide and endotoxemia and all that stuff. And so that's not going to be prevented simply because you're in a calorie deficit.
What happens in your brain when someone tells you that a calorie is a calorie?
Like, I see.
Did you just like lose your shit?
I see like an image of M&Ms versus broccoli like comes to my head. And I kind of think to myself, Do you really think that these two are causing the same metabolic effects in the body when you consume them? It's very obvious that they have different effects. Here's how I try to think about it too. So people always say you have to be in a calorie deficit to lose weight, right? And we sort of take that as gospel. But I'll tell you what, it depends on where you are in the spectrum. If you are obese, okay, and you're eating 3,000 calories of junk food, I guarantee you they're going to lose a ton of fat if they consume 3,000 calories, but it's all from whole foods. So you absolutely can lose weight without being in calorie deficit. It just depends what your baseline is.
I would love to get out and propagate a little bit more, because I think people are still tied to this model. And if you say this, it's like almost, you can say it because you have the MD after your name, but like if we say it, then it's like where it's pseudoscience and it's not proven and all this other stuff. And it's like, yes, it has been proven, but there's an endless amount of counter studies that people can cite. And so it's just like the information out there is just so muddied right now. It's insane. And people are tied into these old paradigms, and it's kind of like hindering the movement forward, right? The progress that we've made in the research and things like that.
Yeah, I will say to add to that, Sean Stevenson does also go over, there's a study where someone ate more a whole food sandwich versus like a more processed sandwich. And the people actually burn more calories afterwards consuming the whole food sandwich. So on paper, the calories were the same, but you almost end up like with less calories in a sense metabolically, because different processes are working better. So I'm sure even though on paper, like you said, you compared 3,000 calories of junk food to whole foods, but the whole foods, you got insoluble fiber, you have protein, you have all these other combinations that almost on paper, it says it's the same calories, but it almost ends up being different metabolically, like you said.
Right.
And
The key thing is too, is it's really people who are overweight that need to lose weight. And it's the people that are overweight have this hormonal imbalance. So simply cutting the calories and eating junk food isn't going to fix the hormonal imbalance. So if you simply switch over to whole foods, even if you're in a caloric surplus, if you fix the hormonal imbalances, right, you're now insulin sensitive, your thyroid hormones are working better, you're going to, instead of storing the calories that you consume as fat, you're going to burn them for energy. So it really comes down to how is your body actually utilizing the calories that you're eating.
With the caloric deficit topic, one thing that I hear a lot about with immunity, and I know you address it in your book, and I know you don't want to give away too much stuff because you want people to actually check out the book, but should you fast when you're sick? because a lot of people, you know, the digestive system having the majority of our immune system in that. And so a lot of people think that ideally giving your digestive system a break, it would be the best thing. So what's your take on that?
I think so. It's almost like with exercise, right? There's like this spectrum of you can get a good too much and not enough. And same thing with fasting. So fasting seems to be good if you do like a 2-day fast every 2 to 3 months to sort of reset the immune system. But when you're acutely sick, your body needs nutrients to fight off the infection. So simply not eating at all is not really recommended.
And then also sticking with that, because I know somebody like myself who has a lot of problems putting on muscle, right? And athletes and things like that who are training. And, you know, we think that we got to get our 1.2 grams of protein per pound of body weight, you know, for gaining, but like, you know, maybe 0.8 for sustainability and for maintaining that muscle mass. Is what is the research shown that you've checked out? Is it able to be, like, say, if you lose some muscle mass for a couple of days, does it bounce back like some people claim? Is there no muscle mass loss because of the growth hormone release that happens with fasting? What's your take on that?
So the research that I've read is growth hormone increases when you fast because the body becomes growth hormone insensitive. It doesn't want to grow when you are fasting. And so just like insulin levels rise when you are resistant to insulin, the growth hormone rising isn't to stimulate muscle growth. It's rising because your body says, I don't want to grow, become resistant to this growth hormone. So that's really key, right? Is kind of making that differentiation. And a lot of people get this incorrect. Even a lot of the quote unquote fasting experts, they say fasting significantly spikes, right, growth hormone, and it does. But it's not for growth. It's to preserve the loss of muscle mass.
Oh, that's so crucial, because so many people, I've been rejecting the fasting community because of that, at least that point of them. I mean, obviously I'm not rejecting all of it, but when they tell me that my muscle mass might actually benefit from it in the long run, I'm like, that can't be, that doesn't make any sense to me. So, no, I'm glad you cleared that up for sure. So, but then you also talked about like the law of diminishing returns with exercise. So I'm assuming that's the same thing. Like, you know, a moderate level of exercise, would you say is a good thing, but too much is immune suppressing?
Precisely. So typically if you exercise between 30 to 60 minutes a day at moderate intensity, maybe 4 times a week, that's going to reduce your risk of upper respiratory tract infections by about 50%. When you start going above that hour at intense, you know, working out at an intense pace or lifting really heavy for over an hour, and you do that for over 3 times a week, that can increase your risk of upper respiratory tract infections by 2 to 6-fold. Now, it's not that you can never work out longer than an hour. It's just that you may need to do certain things to offset the risk. And so in the book, we do talk about certain strategies like East beta glucan, higher doses of vitamin C, not prior to the workout, but in getting it through whole foods. Because if you take synthetic vitamin C, that can actually inhibit some of the benefits that you get when you want to work out. Selenium too can kind of offset that increased risk in upper respiratory tract infections if you want to be someone that hits the gym for longer than an hour.
Great point, because I see with some of my friends, there's a little bit confusion around that, because I think coming back to what you said earlier about one, just because you're on the thin side doesn't mean you're metabolically healthy. And then two, citing people that run marathons, which amazing, an amazing mental feat, but someone who's maybe marathon training is probably heavily taxing their immune system, like you said, depending on how they're training. So I think that's a great misconception that, oh my God, just because they're doing ultra sports doesn't mean like metabolically that's beneficial.
Yeah.
And what's the mechanism behind that? Is that just cortisol is the main issue in that situation that's suppressing the immune function?
I think it's just you reach a certain point where you've overstressed the body. The body is so now focused on rebuilding the damaged tissues. It's now kind of shunting all of its nourishment towards repair. And now there's less, you know, nutrients to say fight off an underlying infection. So it's sort of like your body's nutrient status is competing. Do I use these nutrients to boost the immune system and fight off this infection? Or do I use all these nutrients to rebuild the collagen that I just broke down in the muscle?
That makes sense. So, I mean, since we're already talking about cortisol and all that, what did you see on your research when it came to stress and sleep and obviously, you know, hindering or supporting immune function?
Well, definitely stress and lack of sleep. It's tremendously damaging to the immune system. Again, stress and the elevation in cortisol, the pathway that we think cortisol inhibits immune function is through suppressing what's called interferon regulatory factor 3, which essentially allows us to produce these type 1 interferons, which help us, you know, inhibit viral replication. And then on the other hand, with lack of sleep, we know that the lymphatic system sort of clears out everything in the brain when we sleep and we sort of are repairing. This is like our ability to sort of take care of all the damage that we sort of took on for the day. And melatonin too has tremendous benefits for not only direct antioxidant effects, but increasing your own body's endogenous antioxidant systems. It can activate or increase the transcription of NRF2. So a lot of people know that plant compounds boost NRF2. And how plants do that is they actually inhibit the inhibitor of NRF2. So it's called KEAP1, and they sort of remove KEAP1 from NRF2, and it can work great. Melatonin works differently. It actually, through these clock genes, it can actually bind to the promoter region of NRF2. So it actually increases the transcription. So plant compounds are going to activate the levels that you already have, and then NRF2 or melatonin is going to actually elevate the transcription and increase your total level of NRF2.
Oh, I like that. See, Amanda is more of like, she likes the surface level, and I like the really heady, nerdy explanations. And I'm sure our audience is split like that too. You know, like some people just want to be told what to do, and other people like all the mechanisms and biological breakdown. So that's beautiful. I love that.
Well, I think it helps with a subject like COVID-19 because it is such a sensitive subject. So for you to really break it down and explain the mechanisms, you know, it's not like so much fluffy, like the fluffiness, like, which is why the term boosting, I think, does get some hate, because you even talk about this in the book, how the cytokine storms. I think that was close.
Cytokine storm, yeah.
How an overactive immune system can actually have a negative impact in many ways. I think it's linked to autoimmune diseases. So I think that's also why some people don't like the term boost, because especially for that population, it wouldn't be a good thing.
Yeah, that's true. It's almost like if you're keeping the immune system in balance, if you are someone who has autoimmune disease, it's out of balance. And so you have, instead of, you're overly stimulated, and it's typically a lack of like these T regulatory cells that help regulate everything. And really those regulatory cells are controlled by your dendritic cells, which both of those are controlled by your vitamin A and vitamin D levels and things like that. And so your nutrients are sort of directing your immune system on, should it be active or not active or balanced. And so you really do need to get your nourishment perfect to make sure your immune system is nice and balanced, not overactivated.
One thing that we always stress about on this podcast is gut health. And I know you address it in your book as well. So can you maybe talk about just those mechanisms and the connection between gut health and immunity, and what we can do, the best thing that we can do to build that up and, you know, essentially fortify ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. So how we used to build our immune system is by, you know, playing in the dirt, being outside, ingesting pathogens, and that would stimulate our immune system and increase immunosurveillance. And how you stimulate your immune system through your gut pathway is by your dendritic cells are really the first line of defense. They will see these type of pathogens, and they have these receptors on them that will, and they'll digest them. And then they'll send signals out to your whole immune system and say, wait a second, there's some type of foreign substance. You need to become more activated. Bone marrow, start producing more immune cells, and, you know, start moving around the body more to actually find what's going on. And so a safe, natural way to do that, to mimic an actual pathogen doing that, would be either yeast beta-glucan or medicinal mushrooms. They both have what's called beta-glucans, and some mushrooms have alpha-glucans, and those can actually stimulate your dendritic cells to do those types of functions.
And then with building the microbiome up, can you do that with probiotics, or do you have to do that strictly with vegetables, or do you do a combination of both, like take the probiotics and then fortify it with a bunch of fiber?
I personally have found that the probiotics seem to be more beneficial. They don't last as long though, right? You have to do it every single day in order to get those benefits. Whereas a prebiotics, you got to be really careful, because a lot of people have really messed up guts. They have basically dysbiosis, and you start giving them fiber and that can sometimes be an issue. So sometimes you want to fix the gut dysbiosis first before you just dump a ton of fiber onto someone. It's not that, and a lot of people, you know, they don't tolerate vegetables and things like that because of the gut dysbiosis, but it's not necessarily the vegetables that are the problem, if that makes sense.
So is that something that if you already have gut dysbiosis and then say you introduce a whole bunch of new fiber, you know, and to try to build up your microbiome, is that something that, does that contribute to say like SIBO, like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth and a bunch of other problems? If that's the case, what are some of the symptoms and how does somebody know if they have dysbiosis? Is that be something like if you just have a plate full of broccoli and you start getting gas, is that a symptom of dysbiosis, or is that just like an enzyme deficiency or something like that?
That could be a symptom, but it also could not be. So there are stool tests that you can do. You can look for overgrowth of certain pathogens, fungi, yeast, all that stuff. And there's breath tests too for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth to see how much, I forget what gas comes out. Forget if it's hydrogen or whatnot. I think it's hydrogen because they're fermenting and you're producing this extra gas from that. So there are breath tests to tell if you have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. If you're looking for the cheap route, you can essentially go on an elimination diet, right?
Okay.
Essentially, you go on more of a carnivore diet and then you slowly start adding certain things to see what you can and cannot tolerate. So that's like the cheap way to do it. The better way to do it would be to do certain urinary tests, stool tests, because your symptoms might not be parasites. It could be mycotoxins. And if you don't do a mycotoxin urinary test, you'll have no clue that you're just loaded with mycotoxins. And so it really is, you don't know what you don't test for. So if you do have the money, doing those tests are going to give you a definitive, like, yes, you have overgrowth in this bacteria or you have, you know, candida overgrowth or whatnot. And you're not going to know that unless you actually do the tests.
For our listeners, can you tell them what mycotoxins are? Is that MYCO?
Yeah, MYCO. Yeah, okay. Essentially, it's when you have mold toxicity, these mycotoxins can be produced for, you know, essentially years. And typically they come out in the urine. And sauna does seem to actually be able to eliminate some of those as well. You can eliminate a bunch of other things like heavy metals, phthalates, flame retardants, heavy metals, all these other things through sweat. And it also appears like you can get rid of mycotoxins too through sweating as well.
Does that happen like, say, over accumulation over a long period of time? You know, like it can be slow growth. You're eating a little bit of mold on your fruit here and a little bit of mold there. And then slowly that builds up those mycotoxins. How does that really work?
Yeah, I think I honestly don't think we 100% know how this truly works, right? I think most people are getting this though through mold damage, either in their bathroom, they're living in an old house that has mold, and that's probably where they're getting the spores through the air and things like that. It's probably like your main contributor. I think it could be potentially too through diet, but I think the majority of your really bad cases are going to be, you know, environmental in the bathroom or your house just being filled with mold.
Very crucial. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you people who are living in those old places, you know, time to re-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So I have some questions around vaccines, but I don't want to hop there if you're
No, okay. I'm good.
Because I know you cover that in the book and vaccines are a hot topic right now. So I think just starting off base-wise, how do vaccines work? You know, or if there are a couple different kinds, maybe, like, how does it work in general?
Yeah, so this vaccine is a little different. It actually is forcing your body to produce antibodies against the spike protein. So if you do get coronavirus, and when your body sees the spike protein, it's already primed and ready to sort of attack it and disable it. The problem is that these RNA viruses are highly mutating. And so when you get the flu shot, it doesn't last your whole life. You have to get it every year. And we think that's probably what's going to happen to this coronavirus as well, because there's already numerous different strains and many of them coming out are much more contagious. And this new vaccine probably is not going to cover different variants.
You say in your book, of course, is like, you know, you can get the vaccine, but the number one thing you can also do in addition to that is work on your immune system. So, you know, and obviously if you're elderly and all that, you are, you're at higher risk, you might get the vaccine, but if, at the same time, if you can follow some of the protocols you suggest, then you would also put yourself in a much better position.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what is your take on the COVID vaccine? Do you think that young people even need it? Or should we do it just to be safe? What do you think?
Oh man, that's a tough. I think, you know, it's everyone's personal choice and how comfortable they feel. I think there have been millions of doses that have been given. It seems to be fairly safe. I don't think there's been a large amount of people that have had serious side effects. Although there have been some. So it's like, if you're healthy and young, but then again, do you really know if you're healthy or not? It's hard to say too. So I don't want to give people false hope that they're just because they are have a six pack that they're not going to have issues with COVID, right? So I think it's your personal choice. But me personally, I know I exercise, I know I eat healthy, I'm young, I'm at a very low risk of dying from this and or having a poor complication. So until there's maybe a year or two of safety data, I'm probably going to hold off. That's just my personal opinion.
It's funny that you say that, you know, people that have the preconceived notion that they are healthy and they may not be. Like Amanda and I just took this True Age test. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah.
Like, what do you think of them? Are they accurate? Is it too new to tell? Or
I've never really looked into it. What is it, looking at like your telomeres or something length?
Yeah, I guess so.
It's a step above. So like they first had the telomere test, right? They had that. So I think one of the things it looks at, because I know Dr. Kaffin, who we're doing it with, she said it's better than the telomere test because it looks at a couple different things.
Okay.
But yeah, so we're kind of wondering whether or not I'm nervous because I was just stupid in my 20s. And so like, I'm wondering if that like aged me significantly. So I'm really eager to get that test back and see what my true age is, quote unquote. What would be, if you were to actually try to tell somebody, say they're young and they're healthy and they work out, but they have some issues and you want to basically say, hey, I don't know if you're as healthy metabolically as you may think you are. What are some ways that you can possibly assess that? Are there tests that you can take or, you know, aside from this True Age test, like what would you recommend?
I would say for inflammation, high sensitivity, C-reactive protein. And then for insulin sensitivity, the quickest way would be a fasting insulin level.
Well, I will say I appreciate this discussion around the vaccine because I think it's great to have a nuanced discussion and kind of explain how it works, because I feel like it's either you either love the vaccine or you're an quote anti-vaccine. I'm like, that's not helpful to anyone.
Right.
Yeah, they like to label everybody as a, like, you're either for us or against us kind of thing. And it's so polarized right now. So I'm glad to actually hear some nuance on the subject.
Absolutely. And I'll, you know, just as an example, my dad is over 70, metabolically unhealthy. Love you to death though, Dad. Yeah. And so, you know, I definitely recommend the vaccine for him because, you know, I try to get him to change his lifestyle factors, but there's only so much. I got him working out with a trainer at like 73. So I'm like, okay, at least I got something going.
So as far as other issues around, let's just say focusing on your book, is there any other major issue or factor in immunity that you think that our listeners should be focused on primarily to optimize?
I think if sunlight is an important one too. Even if it's the winter, you can still go out and get sunlight even on a cloudy day. It's much brighter than inside. So just trying to get sunlight as soon as you wake up to set the circadian clock, you release melatonin not just at night, but you also do throughout the day. And that red light in the morning is going to help you produce more melatonin. and trying to get sunlight throughout the day as well, like maybe midday and then also in the evening too, to help those circadian clocks. And then making sure you turn off the lights at night. You know, light at night is just killing your sleep and then killing your immune system. So I think that's something that a lot of people kind of mess up. Like, all my neighbors make fun of our house because we shut, it's basically just like complete darkness by like 5 o'clock. And they're like, how are you eating dinner?
Oh, really?
Yeah. You shut off.
That's smart.
So what do you do? Do you just have candlelight?
No, we have like these little lower under lights under like our cabinets. And so like they're not the main lights, right? They're like the under ones. So it's much less light.
Oh, nice. We need to invest in those.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because now what do you call those rock lamps?
Himalayan salt.
Okay, so these salt lamps, obviously I don't really believe in the like ionizing, but the thing is, they're this really nice low red light, and it's cute, okay? So yeah. Like, I'm in it for that reason. So now I have these like lights around the house, and then I got, they have like a nightlight version that I put in the bathroom too. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, low light, and I try to get Chris, I'm like, okay, lights are off, like we're putting on these like low red light lamps. So that's my little hack if you don't own your home and don't want to install these lights yet.
Yeah, I mean, the other hack is just leave your Christmas tree up. Like, we were using that for like a whole month for light in the morning and at night.
Oh,
that's
beautiful.
Smart. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. As far as anything else in terms of the main points in your book, is there anything else you wanted to cover that our listeners should definitely know to basically just draw more attention towards that?
Yeah, really fresh air and grounding. I know a lot of people think grounding is kind of voodoo science, but there's actually at least 20 clinical studies in humans that have been performed in people that actually ground. And it shows
really
reductions in blood pressure, improvements in joint health. So it's kind of, it's interesting how, you know, it's that actually has clinical evidence to back it up. And then fresh air, how they used to treat, how they treated the 1918 Spanish flu is they would bring people outside for that sunlight, but that fresh air, because fresh air has more ozone and it actually has direct antiviral effects in the air. And so really, in the summer, I keep all my windows open to constantly have that fresh air coming through. And then again, even in winter, you can get outside and get fresh air.
With grounding, could you maybe explain the mechanism behind that? Because I was trying to explain it to somebody, and there were definitely holes in my knowledge. So, so like, how does that work? Is it does it stimulate the vagus nerve, or what is that?
I think, you know, how most of the studies are looking at it is from the absorption of electrons into the system, which can inhibit free radicals, is primarily how. I know it sounds crazy, like, wait a second, humans can actually absorb electrons through the earth through their feet. It sounds crazy, but if we evolved constantly always touching the earth, why would our skin be impermeable to potential electrons on the earth's surface? So it sounds voodoo, but I mean, the clinical studies show benefits with it. So I think people too, when you walk on the beach or you put your feet in the sand, you feel something. And so I think even from that perspective, something's going on there.
Do you have a grounding pad under your desk?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. Oh, is this part of your daily routine then?
Yeah, I try to go outside. I haven't gotten into the whole, I'm going to walk on the snow. Like, I'm not that intense about it. I'm not Wim Hofing it every day.
No,
but
I can't do it.
I know I got dared. We went on a little trip, and this little girl, one of friends' kids of ours, dared me to sit in the snow in my swimsuit. I did it for a hot second, and then I was like, "This is not happening."
It takes a build up. But she's actually done the cold therapy, and actually that was another question I wanted to ask you. Does like the cold, you know, like cold showers and doing the cold tub dips, you know, where you're sitting in cold water for 3 minutes at a time. And some people, you know, they'll talk about like norepinephrine release, and they'll talk about that being immune function. Have you seen any research to support that being kind of an immune boosting health hack?
So typically cold therapies do have some benefits in regards to activating brown fat, right, and increasing fat loss. And mental benefits too have been found with cold plunges and things like that. But when it comes to immunity, we are on the opposite end of the spectrum. Our bodies are meant to actually go to a fever to fight off an infection. So actually making your body cold is the worst thing you can do if you have an infection. And essentially it works through heat shock proteins, which can bind to viruses and prevent viral replication. So, I mean, this is what's really interesting. If you take, they did experiments on cold-blooded animals, and what they did was they would infect them with a virulent pathogen, and they would actually, and they would put them in different rooms, and one end of the room would be really hot and the other end of the room would be like their normal temperature. They automatically selected to go to the hotter end of the room to increase their temperature well above beyond their normal comfortable temperature. And the mortality rate was much lower. So we've known even in cold-blooded animals that if you infect them with a pathogen, they automatically select to make their bodies hotter, and that actually improves their survival.
So cold could be beneficial when you're not sick, basically. Like you can get some right. benefits. And then, but obviously if you think you're sick, you have an infection, you know, that's why you're like under the blankets, you have the feet, like, and then you're like, you get those like cold sweats, like
But you don't want to do a sauna while you're sick, right?
Just... Not if you have an active fever.
Okay.
Right. So like a lot of times you don't know when you're sick, you have it, but you don't have symptoms. So that's why if you're doing sauna therapy, let's say every other day, you're catching it before you even know it, right? You're activating the heat shock proteins that combine to the viral ribonucleoprotein complex and prevent it from being exported, which is how viruses essentially replicate. And so that was for you, Chris, that little mechanism.
Yeah, I loved it. No, it's crazy because what's funny is I had a friend in grad school who grew up in post-Soviet Russia, like was like in an orphanage.
Yeah.
And what they did at the beginning of every winter was took every child outside. They're like all six, from six to like 10, 11 years old, and pour a bucket of water on their head in like the dead of winter. And that was their vaccination for the winter was like they're pouring cold water on their head. And it's like, it's just so funny. Like that, I wonder how old that myth is about, you know, cold plunges and all that kind of stuff, because I'm pretty sure the Soviets didn't hear about health hacks on, you know, like in cold therapy, you know?
Right.
And then is there anything else you want to talk about?
No, that's pretty much it. If you could just let our listeners know where they can find you, where they can get the book. And it was a great episode today. And honestly, we haven't really talked about immune function relating to COVID-19 outcomes. So thank you for going over that.
Sure, no problem. So my website is drjamesdenick.com, and they can get the immunity fix on Amazon.
Well, because everybody botches your last name all the time. Is that what the deal is?
Yeah. Sure. Oh my gosh. I love that my grandmother, when she came over, fought to keep the whole last name. But sometimes I'm like, why couldn't you just let it go, Grandma? You know?
That's what I was saying too. I was like, I was very surprised because, you know, I come from both sides of my family are Italian, and it's the same thing. Like there was some butchering of names with the extended family. So I'm actually very surprised that yours survived that as well.
Yeah. Cause most are Di Nicola, most just get cut off right there and they don't go to the Di Nicolantonio.
Yeah.
You know, I had to like practice saying that, right?
Yeah. I was like, just separate it into two different words, essentially, you know?
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your day today. I think this episode had a ton of value, and we can't wait to catch you guys on the next episode. Bye.